From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a documentary about a farm, a special place in California, the vision of John and Molly Chester, who wanted to raise crops and animals in a place that followed the way a natural ecosystem worked. But getting there was not easy. They've made a film about the experience, which is opening in Salt Lake City tomorrow. John and Molly are joining us after this.
Take KUER wherever you go with our mobile app. Listen to a live stream of the station, get the latest stories from NPR and the KUER newsroom, or explore the newest Radio West podcast. You can even access our 24/7 streams of classical music and the BBC. It's not just any app. It's the KUER app, available for Android and iPhone wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Molly and John Chester had a beautiful vision. They wanted to be farmers, but they wanted their farm to be a place where the soil and the plants and the creatures all lived in this balance, the way any natural ecosystem works. And that meant understanding natural systems and ancient traditions and practices. So about 8 years ago, they found a piece of property, more than 200 acres of pretty neglected land about an hour north of Los Angeles. And they started their project. Two projects, really. The farm and a film. John was a filmmaker before he became a farmer, and he wanted to tell the story of what they were learning. And what they were learning was that finding harmony with nature isn't easy. They had to deal with snails and other pests. They had to deal with dozens of dead chickens and ducks killed by coyotes. They had to deal with aphids and morning glory and algae blooms. And what all of this taught them was to be watchful and patient, and to have faith that things would balance out if they just stuck to their principles. The film they created is opening in Salt Lake City tomorrow. It's called The Biggest Little Farm. We spoke with John and Molly Chester about it at this year's Sundance Film Festival. We recorded our conversation in front of an audience at Utah Olympic Park in Park City. John Chester is a filmmaker, a photographer, and of course a farmer. Molly is a farmer and a chef. Together, they own Apricot Lane Farms in California. I wanted to begin by asking about those two projects, the film and the farm. Did they both go together from the beginning?
Initially, I left the film business to start the farm with Molly with honestly no intention of ever going back. Because I kind of had lost the inspiration as a storyteller and wasn't really getting the kinds of projects that felt as meaningful. And what I started to see was sort of driving this interest. And so we would document and we would do these short stories. We did them for Super Soul Sunday for an Oprah series. And so I was able to do these sort of shorter stories that I could kind of get in and out quickly. It wasn't going to take over my life, but it kept me with a camera, and I was able to, teach interns how to film things. And so they went together in that way, but I never committed to making the film because I didn't really know if I was going to tell the bigger story because I didn't want anyone to run off the cliff like we had. Because I knew we could make it look very intoxicating, but the question remained, would it work?
Yeah. You didn't know it would work, of course. I mean, you had
no idea. Oh, absolutely not. Molly always thought it would work.
Did you?
I just knew that there was absolutely nothing in the entire world that I wanted to do other than that. So I was going to keep going until I went down in absolute flames.
When did that idea come to you? I mean, one of the things you mentioned in the film, Molly was a private chef and she was a blogger, John, of course, a filmmaker, and you guys were living in this very small apartment in Santa Monica when the film begins. So Molly, what was it for you guys? What was it that was missing? And when did this idea of a farm or something like it come to you?
Well, I didn't have the opportunity to grow up in farmland, although I had been very connected to my grandmother's farm and loved that. And there was something in me that when I met John and John taught me different things with gardening, it was always there. And we always talked about this fantasy of being on a farm, but it didn't really have any practical need. And then as I was cooking, the food that I cook is really about healing the body, and that really goes back to the farmer and the choices that the farmer makes about the soil. So then we started visiting different farms and to try to find food for my clients, and we weren't finding exactly what we wanted in some areas. So eggs was one of them. We just wanted eggs done the way that we wanted them done.
Yes.
And so we started fantasizing even more heavily and talking to everyone that we knew about that we had this idea to do eggs. But we were thinking, I don't know, 5 acres. And then we met a partner who enabled us to do it in this very big way. So it happened rapidly. It was...
In the film, yeah, you talk about, John, you mentioned that you wanted a life of purpose. What did that mean? Did you know what that meant necessarily at the
time? Absolutely. I mean, there was a consciousness to what we both were getting into, and it really did start with food, and it started with understanding how the gut microbiome works. And that's something I learned from Molly. And once you're able to visualize that whole thing that's happening with the diversity that necessitates a healthy system, immune system, and your gut microbiome, it all translates to understanding soil. And so we started realizing then the food that we were eating had to first be informed by the soil that it was grown in. And so there was this very clear path, and that felt very purposeful. And then in that process of researching all this, we realized the best soil comes from really a farm that can manage it like a self-contained ecosystem because it needs all those players in it. So it was incredibly multidimensional, and in theory it sounded like, you know, Eden was amazing.
Yeah. Who are you thinking about for inspiration? Joel Salatin came to my mind.
Yeah, Joel came. Yeah, absolutely.
But who are you thinking about? Who are you looking to?
Wendell Berry actually was my biggest inspiration.
Really?
And that's funny. And reading Mary Oliver, I think, you know, you first have to be someone who really gets into seeing and processing the processing of seeing and evaluative process of being still in that. And I think that was what was curious for me, or drove the curiosity for me, was that whole process. And so he made it okay. And same with Mary Oliver, but Wendell Berry made it okay. And then Joel Salatin and Alan Savory, and there's so many others, Gabe Brown, Ray Archuleta. There's a lot of different people I've followed along the years that have inspired me to the practicalities that we follow today.
I heard you, John, talk about how your uncle had a farm, but you wanted to get away from it. So that was a negative experience?
Well, we grew corn and soy for Purdue, you know.
Yeah. Like the polar opposite of where you are now.
Yeah, and no one could figure out why every time it rained, your fields flooded because there was no porosity in the soil. And it was pretty simple, formulaic, and there wasn't any attachment or connection. I remember the most exciting thing we did was donate land to a trust so that we couldn't develop the back 20 acres. And that was about as eco-friendly as my... And it wasn't that we didn't want, or just that there wasn't the knowledge to understand the value of what was the potential was.
We need to tell people about Todd, who is kind of the heart of the story. He's the dog you rescued. And you say in the film, it wasn't until Todd that you could find your way to make that vision happen, that he filled you with purpose. We talk about Todd, because he's the thing that sort of seems to be the impetus to get you going.
Yeah. He started as a rescue animal that I wasn't as on board with John, but then John was working incredibly hard at that time, and I was at home working on a cookbook that I wrote, and so I had the Todd job, and he did every nightmare thing you can imagine as far as chewing things up. I took him to a doggy daycare one time, and they put him out in the backyard, and I said, that's not going to work because I'm not out here. And they said, no, it'll be fine. And I went inside, sat on the couch. Within 30 seconds, the dog was by my leg. And they were like, I don't know how you got in here. We went out, and he had jumped through a six-foot-tall vent that was on the top of a door.
Permission anxiety to the max. One time, we used to use a seatbelt. We seatbelted him into the car. She went into Whole Foods, and she got the PA speaker. Over, it was like somebody's dog is hanging out a window.
Right.
He had gotten out of a six-inch crack and was hanging by his harness. And then, of course, everybody in the Whole Foods parking lot was like, you are the worst human being ever, you know? But we got him citronella spray collars because he wouldn't stop barking. He emptied those canisters. And we got the sonic things. We tortured this poor animal.
Yeah.
It got to the point where we were like, what do we do? We're going to have to get rid of him. We literally thought about having his vocal cords cut. And we're like, what the hell are we doing? You know? And so...
But we loved him and had fallen in love
with him. Yeah, I mean, but we were desperate to not give him up because we had made this commitment to this animal that had been stolen by a hoarder and then lived with this hoarder. It was terrible. And so he gave us permission to, you know, do something crazy.
Yeah.
Because we kept saying, if we had a farm.
I didn't make that connection. Sorry. But yeah, we literally got fell in the confidence in moving for Todd.
It was just the solution.
In a weird way, it felt less crazy because, you know, everyone's like, what are you guys going to do? You don't know anything about farming. I know, but we're trying to save this dog.
No, well, if you're trying to save the dog.
But he is the heart of the film. I mean, he's the creature that most is watching over all the rest of you as you're going through all of this.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
He was always like that.
Tell us about the first time you saw Apricot Lane Farms. First time.
Oh, I remember that. I just remember we were looking for different land, and typically John and I were bickering on our way because he's going, what are we doing? This is crazy. And I was like, come on, let's go.
It's a logical thought.
So, it was logical. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But we went to this one place that I actually did not want to go see this one, and John said he wanted to because it was listed as a horse farm, and I thought, that's not us, that's not going to work. But it had a pond and had all this diversity, it had some orchards and things, so we found our way there, and we pulled off to the side because the agent was coming to meet us. And we get out of the car, and I felt it too. I was like, oh my gosh. And John turned to me and said, we have to make this happen. So that was the first switch. And we then were like very aligned that this was the piece of property. And we hadn't even seen anything yet. There were like some one bee box
we
to the
bees.
Side. Yeah. But it was the feel. You know how you walk into the house you're going to buy or whatever it is, and it's you just know.
But that's interesting that you would know because it was decrepit. I mean, it was dead. The soil was dead.
It was, and we didn't even know enough to know how dead it was. Yeah. That was the problem. We were just like, oh, my God, did you hear that bee?
Yeah. And there's a pond, and there's rolling hills because it felt like back east to us.
It really, it did. It reminded me of a farm back east. And I've got to say, the real estate agent didn't do a good job of selling it because he's like, I've had a hard time selling this place. It's been like 12 years. And I was like, sounds like our place. Let's go see it.
At what point, Molly, did you start to see the possibilities right away?
I was smitten right away. Yeah. And I just loved it. There's footage in the film, actually, of... me going, here we are, we're at Apricot Lane Farms, and Todd, the dog, runs by, and I was just, it is so gross looking. I mean, the trees are horrible, the land is totally dead. I just was, like, in love that we were going to get this opportunity to do this, but now looking back, it's very funny.
The soil was literally white.
Yeah, it was caked. And
we'll say something about that, because this is a really important part of this. The story, the soil, it's dead. As you say, you didn't really know. What did you know about the importance of soil in terms of like the bigger picture then?
Well, I definitely knew that the soil was obviously a very important component to the healthy food sort of system that we were trying to create, but I didn't understand how actually dead the soil was. And by that, I mean, like, I'm not big on like kind of being divisive with like conventional farming versus organic and holistic, because all these things are choices that are made that are driven by consumer decisions. So really the choices are is in how we want people to farm. But they were preventing anything from growing except for the crop. So they were using, you know, as they use even on playgrounds, they were using Roundup to kill everything. So there was nothing feeding this, the soil microbial life.
It was so, just propping up.
It was a trees. Yeah. It's a medium with which to hold a tree up, and anything else was in competition, and that's where, you know, over the past, you know, 60-100 years, that's where we've gotten. So to then reestablish that so that it would even grow grass was a 3-year process. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't grow anything. And not because, you know, not to imply that because there was Roundup still in the soil, it's because there was nothing to support the life of the grass. And that process had to be repeated 3 times in a place where there's a water shortage, where the year we move in, they decide to cut back the water use for all farms by 25%. And we're the only farm in the area who decides to also grow grass under their trees. And people are like, there's a water shortage. And I'm like, well, I've read that this might actually help and sequester water, and I could go on.
John Chester. He directed the biggest little farm, along with his wife, Molly Chester. They own Apricot Lane Farms in California. The biggest little farm opens tomorrow at Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City. For information, just go to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio, and starting Monday, May 27th, our show is taking a break. After 18 years, we're stepping back to rethink what the show does well and what it could do differently. The plan is to return with a new Radio West at the end of the summer. And until then, you can get updates from me by signing up for our newsletter. It's all at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a documentary about a farm, the vision of John and Molly Chester, who wanted to raise crops and animals in a place that followed the way a natural ecosystem works. But that is not easy to pull off, which their film shows. It's called The Biggest Little Farm, and we spoke with them at this year's Sundance Film Festival. The film is opening tomorrow in Salt Lake City. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later on the program. Tell us about Alan York, another kind of heart to the film in some ways.
I think the big thing to start with is that we didn't know, we knew we needed help. We'd read a lot of books. We'd talked, you know, I truly cold called farmers and just asked them questions. And it's great because I came from the film business. And if you cold called anybody in the business, like, good luck, man, they're going to hang up after 3 seconds. Yeah. Farmers are like, oh, yeah. And 3 hours later, I'm just like, oh, my God, it's amazing. So we knew we needed some advice. And so really it was Molly who decided that we were going to focus on several different type of methods, you know, of regenerative agriculture. And she was the one that knew or found our mentor.
Yeah. A big inspiration for me was the Weston Price Foundation, which teaches a lot of traditional food methods. And through there, I had become privy to Demeter, which is biodynamics. It's more of a whole system approach and the ecosystem approach, and it felt like a lifetime, just this ideal you're trying to achieve. And then that was just the initial step for us, and then since then, we have a lot of different tools in our belt that we use all to kind of find the essence of our farm, because that's really what you have to do.
Let me play a moment from the film. This is when one of the first times you're meeting Alan, he comes to the farm, he's walking around with you, he's pointing out the weeds and the crappy soil, and as you'll hear from John, we'll also hear from Molly and Alan, it didn't exactly look the part of a farmer.
He's like this world-renowned expert in traditional farming practices.
And he shows up wearing all linen and sandals.
I can't even get in an inch.
But there was this emphatic cadence to his speech that made him sound believable.
This is devil weed. By the end of the day,
You will have such hate for this plant, you burn this shit, man, as if it's a ritual.
Oh, Molly, here's another of my favorite plants.
Puncture weed.
What does that do?
Look, just grab a hold. Do you love it?
No.
Damn, Molly.
You don't love it.
I hate it.
Molly thinks he's great.
Molly.
But his goal for the farm sounds almost too good to be true.
The objective is to emulate how natural ecosystems work. They regulate themselves through diversity. So you don't get epidemics of pests and disease.
John, what did you mean when you said his goal seemed too good to be true?
There was this, if you build it, they will come sales pitch that Alan always was trying to explain, but in very flowery words that were defined from his experiences growing up in the 60s. And trying to explain things in words that I couldn't even begin to visualize how this was going to all come. I wanted to believe it, but I didn't want to be like, I didn't want to be fooled and then be like, I was more of that kind of skeptic. Like, I wanted so much to believe it. So yeah, he would just use very interesting flowery words that I didn't understand at the time.
His vision was so... I'm not sure, Molly, if you got on board right away with it, because his vision was so big.
I was ready to go. Yeah. That was, I loved it. And Alan had a very unique quality to him that he did use the flowery words. And, you know, it was hard to totally grasp certain things. It's kind of any mentor that you have, you know how they only kind of give you even what you can do at that point. So he knew so much more than what he could even say, but he had to give us baby steps. But he also was extremely practical. So when he would come, he would leave, and I had, you know, 6-page list that John and I had to do, and I was able to kind of check through it and just follow a protocol to get myself to the next step.
He said to get it right. Once you get it right, it's going to seem like surfing. What did he mean?
He meant that the energy would be coming from nature. We would be finding the solutions within the system that we had created and rejuvenated. Don't those sound like very flowery words? But he would not overly define them, but he was constantly saying that don't worry, all the work you're doing right now is going to come back, you know, tenfold, and it may take 20 years. And I'd be like, excuse me, hold on a second. What's this 20 years thing? And he was like, well, you know, before you like really see it, but you'll see something in 7.
He said 3 and 4, we would want to like run for the hills and quit, which was very accurate. I mean, I didn't want to quit, but it was very, very hard. And then 5, he said you'd start to see something that gives you a little energy. And by 7, you're like, wow, this is great. And by 10, you're like, I would never do anything
else. He said you'll wonder why no one else is doing it this way.
Yeah. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
We're in year 8.
But I would say...
It's feeling great, but yeah.
At this point, the exciting thing that happens is every layer of the onion that you go down, you start to be able to see more layers of the onion. And
right.
Once you realize the power of starting that flywheel and getting the ecosystem working, that power is infinite. And so you realize how much further you can go. And so that's where it's just that never-ending quest that's so exciting.
He set up soil like, he kind of explained it like this. He's like, it's this grand alchemizer of life, from death to life. There is in the middle of, like, we talk about the circle of life. And he's like, what you're trying to do is create this flywheel effect that has this pump, this engine. And while we think of it in terms of a circle, it's actually an 8. And that 8 goes through this cross section, and that cross section is soil. So up here is things that are alive, and here are things that are decomposing to then ultimately feed all life that we know. And he goes, you need to provide enough life on top so that that soil can start up that cycle and that pump, and everything gets healthier. The crops, the animals, and all of those pest pressures start to become more balanced. The animal issues become more balanced, but you have to get the pump working. And so he would just spend all day, like, picking apart soil and showing it to me. And Molly would sit there with a clipboard and be like, really? Is this necessary? We have to move these trees.
I get it now.
And I'm like...
Here's another moment from the film.
We're farming over 200 different things. And Alan claims that all of this diversity will somehow lead to simplicity.
The flywheel is being built. So now it becomes self-perpetuating and self-regulating.
So I picture this circle full of life. Plants, livestock, wildlife, all working together. Pushing us forward, building our soil, living in harmony. That would be great.
Always you're looking for opportunities to integrate so that everything works in harmony.
For example, we've established cover crops to rebuild our soil. The problem, this requires more labor to mow them. But Alan quickly shifted our lens, calling it a problem with an opportunity.
Well, talk a little bit about that, because it seems like this is the thing you had to learn was don't freak out, be patient, figure this out, and then you'll know what the opportunity is. But you kind of had to earn it, it seemed.
Every failure that you have, I think, in life, professionally speaking, is immediately coupled with embarrassment. And then there's the fear of how long you're going to be in this embarrassment phase. So the trick that we've learned is that moment of embarrassment is the moment where you need to actually not do anything to fix it. You need to just start to watch it and understand what fuels it. And then you can begin to hack into the opportunities to change its direction in a way that the ecosystem can live with and you can live with. But it's not going to be perfect. But that's every single, you know, problem on our farm now. Whereas there's this immediate flush of embarrassment. Oh, my God, we look ridiculous. This is not working.
And look at all these snails.
Right, and then it's, well, you're going to lose all the crop. Well, if you wait, you got to. That's the first thing we get even today from the guys is, you know, they'll be like, well, we got this problem. We got to fix it. We're going to lose all the trees. And I'm like, well, we can fix it all the way, but we'll never know what caused the problem. We'll never know why the problem exists. We'll never know where this problem can lead us. When you talk like that with people, there's a lot of anxiety that is produced over that sort of like almost carefree sort of way of viewing failure. But it ultimately is what led us to the discoveries that we were able to stumble onto and see.
It must have been really tempting. There's this story I've heard you talk about. It's not actually in the film, but where you have this explosion of morning glory. And the crew is like, guys, we've done all this natural stuff. We need to kill it with chemicals. We've got to do something. And so it must have been tempting to say, all right, let's just, this one time, let's give in. So talk a little bit about that, because this seems like one of those moments.
We spent a lot of money on Morning Glory. We had, you know, arguably 160 acres of Morning Glory.
It was kind of the final step to us really stepping into every single aspect of the farm, because we had, when we first started, we worked with an outside orchard company, management company for a little while, and then we brought an in-house management, and that's Orchard is like one of our 8 farms that are within the farm. So I was working with him all the time, and we were just basically using this just eradication. You know, we were going to conquer the morning glory. And so we had everyday teams out there picking the morning glory. We were going to get it. We had schedules to go back through the same system and all this. And I just started to be like, this is not working. And John was, you know, in my ear saying, this is not good. This is what is going on. And so we started to try to look creatively, and our team was not behind. They were having trouble seeing that there was any other avenue, understandably, because it was looking like there wasn't. And we actually had suggestions to, let's take this piece of land that we were really having the trouble with out of certification, fix this problem, and then go back in certification. And
how to fix it.
By spraying Roundup, basically. Yeah. And I knew in my gut that there was absolutely no way that I was willing to go back to that. So then that's where creativity happens.
We started calling around. We're like, how do you fix morning glory if you just don't want guys pulling it all day long? And we had a guy said, well, you buy geese. And we're like, well, what do the geese do? Well, the geese can actually eat the morning glory work. Sheep can't eat it because it's the seeds are hallucinogenic to the sheep.
Wow.
So your sheep are out there tripping, you know, eating this morning glory. And you can't send your cows out in the orchard because the cows will just eat the trees. This guy's like, geese, it's great. And I'm like, well, you know, he goes, but you know what? He goes, I got a little trouble with having my geese out there. And the Department of Ag said I had to put diapers on them because they were... So the guy like was telling me how he was going to do this whole thing. I'm like, all right, well, let's just get some geese. And so we got some geese, and we had these.
We did not put diapers on.
Yeah, we didn't have to put diapers on because he had ground crops and stuff like. We have tree crops. It's a little different for the interaction. We get the geese. We're so proud of ourselves. They're eating the morning glory. It's going great. We come out. There's like, this is a sad story, but I've never seen so many feathers. The coyotes just destroyed the geese, you know, and we were like, ah, here we, you know, we're trying to play by the rules, you know.
Yeah, that was really hard. But so at that moment, it was the moment John and I had to step in to fully manage the orchard because we just realized we had to be out on that ledge by ourselves, and we did. And
so to figure it out, we figured out when does morning glory peak, when's its best season, when does it sort of start to take a break, and what other grasses or plants like to grow when it's sort of taking its break. And we planted all that stuff during the break period, and that stuff came in and outcompeted the morning glory. And essentially, I'm going to knock on wood, because you never know, but right now we've conquered the morning glory problem just by simply deciding what plant we can plant when it's taking its sort of knee and not sort of flowering and doing its thing. So we were able to use the system, the ecosystem, to battle it.
You mentioned the coyotes and the geese, and this is a constant problem that you talk about in the film, what you do about coyotes killing your ducks and killing your chickens. There's one scene in the film where you see a coyote and you run to grab your gun. Tell me about the decision that you're having to make, how you're thinking about it in that moment, because I'm thinking there's a lot of stuff going on in your mind. One, there's got to be another way for me to do this without killing this predator. He fits somewhere in this system.
I didn't know where he fit in the system.
Right,
the time.
Right.
Yeah.
But then you're frustrated because he's killing your animals.
Yeah.
So just talk me through how you're thinking about that.
We've lost, you know, probably 350 chickens. You know, and the neighbors are like, oh, I'd shoot a coyote for chewing an irrigation line. Like, they're like, you know, don't worry about it, man. Just it's part of what it is. And I was like, it got to the point where the embarrassment and the community of even my own team was like, who is this fair for? You're worried about one life, the coyote's life, over 350 chickens, half of which my team is named.
Yeah.
You know? And they do, you know, and then when you tell them not to name them, they just give them numbers, but numbers become names.
They can't help themselves, right?
It's like, yeah. I mean, number nine. No, not number nine. So that moment was like, it was embarrassing, and obviously it was a big turning point for me.
You say there was this moment when you sort of saw at the moment die or dying your belief in the idea of uncompromising idealism.
That was, yeah. The death of the coyote was essentially the in opposition to the same idealism that we gave to Todd. Like we gave Todd this, look, we said we're going to not get rid of you. This is the last home you'll live in. And we will not compromise on that. And by not compromising on that, it took us through this incredible journey to land in this, I think I say in this film, in this very beautiful place. And that's what sometimes not compromising does. And I just, like, in one decision had shattered all of that in my mind, in that decision to kill the coyote.
Along with all of this life is, of course, the reality of death. And I wanted to ask you about how you learned to cope with all of that. You say there's this irony here in some ways where you're trying to save these animals that you're eventually going to kill for food. And there's this bond that develops, even though you know where some of them are headed. Would you talk about that part?
Where I've landed after my journey, and I think Molly would probably agree, is that it's an inescapable truth that all life fuels life. All of us have blood on our hands, whether you're a vegetarian or a vegan or a meat eater. Death is a requirement that has built this incredible immune system that is the planet, that is self-regulated through that process. And it's not meant to justify the decision, but when a life is taken and processed in the way that we would process it, or buried into the ground, it is broken apart and redistributed, arguably miles by mycorrhizae fungi. It can source the nutrients of a decomposed gopher and take it to a tree that needs a specific, you know, potassium or other nutrient that it's sort of mined off of that and feed it to that tree. And so you start to look at the passing way differently. And it doesn't make it easier necessarily, but it's not nothing. You know the energy keeps going. And so it's not that. And that helps me. I don't know if that's an easy thing to understand.
I wonder, John, working on these wildlife projects all over the world, how did that compare to photographing the animals on the farm? The way you capture animals in their space and environment, did it translate in the same way?
Well, I think I at least had the patient, knowing the patients and the difficulty. They're like, what, in the film business, say, working with kids and animals. But then there's like the wildlife part of it. It's the whole other factor. And I think I at least had that patience, but now I had this whole entire like lab where I lived. And I didn't have to worry about like the crew's overtime hours. You know, I shot an ant being fed honeydew from an aphid for 6 years, I think. I drove an intern, actually almost, poor Kyle, almost nuts over this one. But we finally got the shot. But
it's beautiful, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And thank you, Kyle, too. The patience was infused by that. But the interesting thing was that I was in South Africa on a job working with wildlife vets before we started this. And the connection to the farm was that these guys were all farmers before they were running this game park. And what they had done is they had overgrazed all their land with the sheep. They didn't really understand that. They lost their farming business. And when they realized what they had done and that they had mismanaged their system, they were like, well, now that we understand that, we understand how to run a game park, because now it's about stocking density, the right number of springbuck to the number of lion. And, you know, if you're losing too many springbuck, you got to take a lion out and trade it with another park. If you have too many springbuck, you put a lion in, because you don't want the springbuck to, like, sit there and graze all the grass with no predator to kind of keep them moving fearfully along, because they'll overgraze that grass and make it completely, eradicate it. So I came with that understanding to Ventura, or at least, you know, the farming community we were in, not very receptive to that way of thinking. So that was like a little bit of confidence that I had, because I'd watched other people lose what they had and have to rebuild it back with a new understanding.
One of the things you've talked about was that there were times when you worried your ego was getting in the way of the process of shooting the film, because you had said to the people who were shooting it, there may be times when I tell you not to shoot this. Do not pay attention to me. Tell that story, if you would.
Yeah, too conscious of the process and so vulnerable about what I didn't know was coming and how ridiculous I would look, that I did in moments of clarity. I'm like, once I decided to make the film, I said to the team, I said, I'm going to tell you not to film something at some point, don't listen to me no matter what I say. And it happened a number of times where I was just caught in the middle of something and I would turn to them and like, shut it off. And then afterwards, I would be like, did you guys keep rolling? They're like, yeah, we've got the whole thing. It's like, oh my God, really? Oh, I'll never use that. It's all in the film.
Yeah, that's the best stuff.
It
right?
really is. And I didn't know if I was going to make it out of it. You know, there was times when I was suturing an animal and I didn't know how to suture. So I was on YouTube, and I have YouTube here with how to suture on my left side, and the interns over here, so they couldn't see me.
Yeah.
That was learning how to suture.
Thank God for YouTube. I want to talk about, there's this moment when Emma, this grand character in the film, she's the pig, is sick. And not only that, there are snails everywhere that you haven't figured out yet quite what to do. And the other pests you haven't figured out. And a lamb is born deformed. You have to put some ducks or chickens that have been mutilated by predators out of them. I mean, there's a lot going on at this time. And at this point, you're trying to get Emma to eat something so she can live. And you say something here in this clip, and I want to play this moment and ask you a little bit about it.
You gotta eat, Emma.
It's all like this slow disillusionment of our earnest intent. Intent alone is not a protector.
What do you mean?
Well, I think that we feel like we're shielded, because we want to do good, that we're shielded in some way to find success. And that in that process, how could it ever be the good act that could actually cause harm to something, especially something alive like a pig, you know, that you think you're giving a better life to? And, that was a reoccurring lesson in the process.
Let me play another moment from the film I want to ask you about. You, there's another problem you're dealing with. So the ducks naturally are pooping in the pond. It's what they do. And it's causing, because there's no fresh water for the pond, there's this huge algae bloom. And that's another problem. And then you notice something, or I think you noticed this along the way, and it was how Todd is keeping an eye on everything. And it's a kind of an important insight. Here's another moment.
I feel like Todd is constantly staring deeply at these almost infinitesimal details. Like he's decoding how the world around him works. So I've started doing the same. And I think I've figured out what ducks love more than ponds. So with every new problem that popped up, I'd first take a step back and watch it.
Was that the most important? I mean, of all the things, it seems like that was one of the most important. That idea, we talked about it a little bit before, was this idea of just hold on a minute, just watch first.
It's so is. I like doing this thing where I go out with new interns on the farm, or even people that tour the farm occasionally. We'll pull back some grass in the soil, and I'll say, here, come down, look at the soil. And they're like sitting there, and they're trying to be like, oh, wow, that's amazing. And I'm like, no, keep looking at it. And they're like, oh, yeah, wow, is that a worm? And I'm like, yeah, just keep looking at it. And they're like, oh, what was that? And I'm like, yeah, did you see that little white thing? And then I say, just keep looking. And it's like this... this stacking, this layering of like these things you start to see, and you're like, oh my, wait, then they're like, oh my God, is that all moving? And they start seeing these things. And it's a really cool exercise, and it's so simple, and it's so hard to do when you're in those moments of like, oh, this is crazy, we gotta fix this. But it's everything, you know?
One of the things you say is that Alan York, he was making the farm so complicated, and he had all of these grand visions, and you felt like you were going to be reliant on him forever. At what point did you feel like maybe you had this by yourselves, at least in some way, that you were learning to the point where you didn't have to be reliant on someone else's vision?
I think for me, it was probably after the Morning Glory situation. And I think Alan, in all of his amazing strengths, didn't understand animals as much as orchards. And there was a layer of integration that we were ready to take even beyond. And I think that was where we needed to fly out of the nest.
I mean, there was I won't give it away, but there's an unfortunate circumstance that happens that forced us into a sort of a solo journey with this way too soon. To answer your question, around year five for me was when I started to see things that I had never actually ever seen in the numbers that I'd seen on the farm before. And forcibly let things kind of linger on problems long enough to see something in the ecosystem respond to it. But because of decisions we had made 5 years ago to have habitat for those things to exist, to have babies there, to want to even be there, to be there in response to the things that they would then solve. So that was like, oh, maybe that's how it'll work forever.
Can you ever find true balance? Or are you constantly having to fine-tune it? Alan told you that it would get more predictable. But it seems like then you would have to think that nature is somehow perfect, that there is a balance, that there is a perfection you can somehow attain. Everything is working perfectly. Is that possible?
I definitely believe that imperfection is perfection, more so now than ever before. And I think you have to embrace everything. And I don't think that you achieve some goal of alchemy in a way that's finished.
I keep going back to the way the planets, the whole entire immunology of the planet is structured. It is a giant living organism that is self-regulating. And what fuels that is this entire web of mutualism. But for perfection to be part of mutualism, it's like it's the anti. Because you have to make way for all the other things that require the same space that you're in. So I think perfection is exactly what we're trying to achieve in the over-sanitization of our food system, you know, even of our health in a way. That the beauty is in the imperfection. And honestly, the real opportunities for, you know, I think evolution on our farm is in seeing in those imperfections and that lack of cooperation, a better way to live that you hadn't even envisioned because you were trying to force your will and your view of happiness on it. I think that's what's like shaped us in profound ways that we didn't expect. Like we're living in a way that we didn't really envision even was possible.
Yeah.
There's this moment in the film when Emma is having babies and baby after baby after baby after baby. And Molly, in the background, you say, "This is so fun. I love our life." Like, it's one of my favorite moments in the film in some way, because it was this kind of sort of, they just captured this moment of joy. And I know it wasn't, you don't feel that way all the time, but you've talked about how in some ways this is a love story.
Yes.
Say something about that finally.
Yeah, I would say for me, it's a love story between us and the land. It's a love story between John and I having to figure out things. But as you fall in love with the earth, it just makes you go further and further and further to figure things out for her. And I think that's just the never-ending inspiration. And that was very authentic to say I love our life in that way. I mean, I feel so exuberant in that so often at the farm. Even in the hardest day, you get out and you ride your little cart back home and you're looking at all the, just the, it's just so gorgeous.
Yeah, like Wendell Berry, there's a Wendell Berry quote that he says, it all turns on affection.
Yeah.
And I look at, I've been a documentary filmmaker, so we've been in this world of documentary films where they try to scare you into caring. And that doesn't work. And that quote says it. It says it all because it all truly does change when you can start to love something. Like, I often say, like, if my son, who's four now, one day drives a tractor into the pond, I'm going to see beyond that because I have so much love and affinity for this child. I see his potential. So I'm going to go through whatever it's going to take to make it so that he doesn't do that again and let him know that he has the potential to improve. And when I look at the farm, the thing that drives us every day is this, like, absolute love for it because we've been able to see it, and that's what keeps us going back to it. And so I think if we're, like, as a culture trying to get people to care about the earth, it's not going to be because we tell them they're going to die or things are going to go wrong, and it's just because that's not going to work. It's if we can show them how incredibly beautiful it is and they find something that they love in it, they will never let it die.
Yeah. And you can see it in everything. You can see it in the plants coming up in the middle of concrete. You know, it's just, you don't have to be, we are in a very lovely place and that's extra easy. But once you start to get that bug and that connection, it's just, you can't stop seeing the magic.
Molly and John Chester, they own Apricot Lane Farms in California. John directed the film. It's called The Biggest Little Farm, and it opens tomorrow at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.